So, hello everybody. Thank you for attending this this talk. I know it's right after lunch, so you might be well. Thank you for being here. So, my name is Doji. I work for Red Hat in the tools team, and my background is a little bit in compilers and debuggers. And since a little while, I've been working on static analysis of ELF binaries to infer interesting things about ABI and stuff. So as a result, we came up with a framework named ABGAL, which is an acronym for ABI Generic Analysis and Instrumentation Library. Well, it's also the name of the wife of the guy we started the project with. So anyway, so we use ABGAL to basically compare binaries and come up with reports about the differences they have as far as ABI is concerned. So this can be really interesting to folks ranging from developers up to people pushing bits coming out of the developer's hand, namely distro people. And I thought it would be interesting to come and talk to you guys about what we've been doing in this area, and maybe we can find areas where we can work together and improve what we have, or change directions. Discuss. So today's talk, I'm gonna first try and define what we mean by ABI. This is a quite fluid concept. It's not well defined, and so it means different things for everyone. So I thought it would be an interesting take to try to define what we actually mean by that in this project. And then we'll talk about what we mean by ABI compatibility once we have a definition for the ABI. And then I'll jump straight to some examples of change reports we can have with the framework we have today. Once we have that, we'll dive into what ABGAL is, what it does, how we perform those static analysis tasks, and see how it is used in real life today. And then we'll talk about possible improvement. I say we'll talk because I'll present something, but if you have ideas, please feel free to come up with those. And so here we are. To define what an ABI is, let's set a context first. Okay, suppose we have a binary, which we'll name E, and that binary uses a code from another binary that we call L. So basically, E can be an executable, that's where the E comes from, or a shared library. If there is something that is not clear, please just stop me right ahead, rather than waiting for the end. So that's what E is, and L can be, a shared library. It's a library, that's where the L comes from. And it can also be a dynamically loaded module. So this is the basic context. So at execution time, what happens is that E expects properties from L. In this context, I wanted to say that we're talking about mostly about ELF, the ELF Linux format right now. This is what we support. We could support other things in the future, but right now we're talking about ELF. So E expects properties from L at execution time. So those properties can be things like the format of the binary, the architecture, an executable, an x86 executable will expect an x86 library, for instance, right? x86 dwarf, ELF will expect an x86 ELF library, for instance. It will also expect the presence of certain ELF symbols, symbols coming from either functions or, you know, global variables or other things. Specific layout of data. When I talk about this, I mean types, you know, specific types of data and a specific, you know, size, alignment, you know, offset, et cetera, et cetera. There are also other stuff like, you know, calling convention, et cetera, et cetera. But the first three are the things we're going to focus on more here. So I wanted to stress also that those properties are structural. They talk about the structure of the program, not its behavior. We're not talking about bugs where we were supposed to add two numbers and we are now dividing them, things like that. We're not talking about dynamic things. We're talking about structure, you know, types, layout, things like that. So those properties that are loosely defined somehow are what we call the ABI. Those properties that E expect from L. Those are the ABI of L. So more specifically, when we talk about the ABI of a library or a binary in general, we'll be talking about the set of symbols that it defines and exports, and also the layout of the data expected by those symbols. So from now on, I will stop talking about symbols. I'll talk about functions, you know, and variables, because, well, that is what programmers care about, even though a function in source code end up being, okay, usually a symbol, right, in ELF. But we want to talk about things that are meaningful to developers, so I'm going to talk about now functions and variables now. So one thing to keep in mind is that ABI changes are there to stay. They're inevitable in our free software world. I mean, we want our software to evolve. You know, we've been talking about this during all these 3 days. So we don't want to cast things in stone and say, oh no, you can't change anything anymore because you're gonna break ABI. Whatever that means. Things are going to change, and the ABI is going to evolve. Because we are fixing bugs, we are adding features, we want to kick ass, basically. So we're going to add new functions, we're going to add new global variables, we are going to change the signatures, and types, and whatever of the existing functions. All those things are going to happen, and we want these things to keep happening. But then, what we want is to be able to detect the subset of those changes that are harmful. So, can you read this? Yeah. So, in this context, to us, only what we call ABI incompatible changes are harmful. For instance, if you remove a function that was there and that was there in L in the library and that was expected by the executable, that is a harmful ABI change. It's an ABI incompatible change because existing E's, you know, existing binaries, executable binaries that are in nature, well, will expect that function that you removed from your newer version of the library. The same thing goes for incompatible data layout changes. Basically, you have a type in which you removed a data member, things like that. Or removed or added a function parameter, things like that. So you see, I'm not talking about symbols anymore at this point, even though we're looking at binaries. And it follows that ABI compatible changes are fine. They're fine, but we might need to see those, you know, to still see them and review them and be sure that, oh, this change, even though it's not bad, is really a kind of change I expected, you know, just from looking at the binary. So one thing to keep in mind is that we want to be able to detect all those things by looking at the binaries only, not by looking at the source code, you know. This is really important to keep in mind because, well, there are many reasons why we want this, but I think most of the distro people get this, right? When you have, well, compilation is a kind of destructive process. There are some information that are not there anymore, but there are also some information that are there that you can't see when you look at the source code. For instance, when you look at, well, we'll see that later in some of these examples that I have. But when you look at a data structure, a class or a struct, for instance, you don't know what the offsets of the data members are just by looking at the source code. You have to think, right? But when you look at the binary, boom, you have those information. So looking at the binary is really interesting because it reveals things that are hard to see when you just look at the source code. And we want to be able to detect those things as soon as possible. You know, it's not when you are building the final stage of the distro that you want to detect those things. As soon as possible in the dev process is what we want. And we need to keep in mind that there is no magic here. Most of the interesting changes need a human review. You know, to know if they're harmful or not. So you need to make those changes stick out, you know, from the noise, and then have some folks to review them, just like you review, you know, patches. So for that, what we want to use is to use the diff paradigm we have already, to let people review those ABI changes just as we review patches today, which is something we don't do yet, right? But this is the philosophy we're following while developing those tools and framework and so on and so forth. So, yeah, I danced ahead the music here. So let's look at some examples. Okay, so this is the place where the time where I switched it. So in this case, I just wanted to show you something very quick. I have a friend here, Frederic, who told me once, you know, it was probably 15 years ago or something, that showing code about what you're demonstrating is a really bad thing to do, right? But here, I'm not showing the code of LibAbigail. I'm showing the code. Well, LibAbigail works on code, so I'm not, you know, it's different what I'm doing. So here, I wanted to show you, I hit this. So here you have a small function, you know, F1, that has one parameter. And here you have in a new version, F1, on another version, in which I added a parameter, right? And I probably, yeah, that's the only thing I did, I guess. So I wanted to show you what a LibAbigail-based tool, you know, sees. So I've compiled these things.
I can run the compiler again, just to show that I'm not...
This is an artist setup, and it's like I'm on a piano or something. And yeah, okay. So, I compiled this, and I'm just calling a tool named ABI Diff, and I give ABI Diff the first version of the binary. You know, lib example one. Yeah, I wrote this morning while having a chat with a fellow here. So I couldn't find a better name. I was more involved in our discussion. So libexample1.so.0 compared to libexample1.so.1. Oh, boom. Oh, sorry. I should put that in a redirect that into a a file named ABI. So have you seen what I did? So I called a binary program named ABI diff, right? It's a program part of the libabigale toolset that compares the ABI of two binaries, ABI diff. And so here is the result of what it says. So can you read that? Yeah. Okay, it just says that here, so it shows you, so it says the function F1, like, you know, with its signature, has some changes in one of its subtypes, right? And the change is that the parameter 2 was added. That's all. And this is actually what we did. If I do a diff of the source code, V1. So you see here the sort, do you see that? Can you read that? So this is the diff. And so this is and so this is the source code, and this is an example of the kind of report you get, you know, from looking at the binary. So you see that even though you're just looking at the binary and its debug information, because I've compiled this with debug information enabled, you can have quite some detailed information, right? Line numbers, et cetera, et cetera. So we can move to something more involved with, you know, C++. So here we have, in blue here, we have a class. Don't really need to read the details. We have a class here, and that class is used by another class, a structure. It is used here because we use C. You know, class name is C, and we use C in another type underneath here. And you see, I still have a function named F1 that uses C, and I have a function named F2 that uses C2, that uses C as well here, right? And of course, on the second side of the screen, there, the thing that is highlighted in blue is, well, I created a base class. So I changed C and made C inherit a new class like this. You know, I was listening to the fellow over there. So this was my, it's because of him, you know, that inspiration came from you. So I just made this change. And well, I was like, okay, how about adding a virtual here, for instance, in the class? Well, the idea is just to make some changes and see what ABI div says. And I kept F1 as is, you know, I didn't change the signature. And I kept F2 as is too. Oh, well, there is also an F3. But anyway, let's go. Did I try it? Oh, yes. So I compiled it as previously. And I guess, oh, yeah. I'm putting the result into a file. So I'm running ABI diff on the two binaries, putting a result into a file, text file, and then I'm opening the text file in Emacs. So the changes are interesting here. So first, let's look at the summary of the changes that is shown by the tool. The tool says that there is one function that was changed. Change means that one of the types used by the function, or subtypes, you know, types of those types, changed, right? And it also says that one function was added, you know. Adding a function is not a problem, right?
as I said earlier, it's an ABI change, but it's not necessarily a product. But we still want to see it and review it and be sure that, you know, this change is really what we meant. So we see that, and it says that the function that I added was C, the get M0.
Did I add a function? I don't think so. I mean, I don't remember. So let's look at, So this was the first class I had. So you see get
M0 was
already there in the first version. And in the second one, what did I do? In the second one, I still have get M0. But you see, I had a little change here in F1. In F1 here, I called, you know, I invoked the get M0. You see here in blue? Whereas in the first case, there was no code. Okay. So in this is C++. Get M0 here is inlined. You know what inline means? So it's not generated per se. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Get M0 is inline. So it's not generated, right? By default. But in the second case, it is generated. GCC generates it because it is called. Because someone uses it, then it is generated, you know? This is also because I compiled without optimization. If I compile with optimization, we can try that later because we're, you know, time is flowing. You'll see that this added function will disappear because of optimization, the function is just inline and not generated as a symbol, right? So these are the interesting things that you see when you just look at the binaries rather than looking at the source code. The same source code can produce different binaries depending on how you compiled it, how you change the code, etc., etc. This is what I meant by when I was saying we want to look at the binaries only, you know, well, being able to look at those. So added function. You see? Oh, and in here, you see the symbol of the function, right? And here you see its signature, right? And so let's look at the changes, what it says. So first, it says that the return type of F1 changed. Of course, it's true. I changed it from void to int. So we catch that. So you see that just by looking, okay, there are some tools around that would say, that will just look at the symbols. And because in C++, the symbols are mangled, you know, you could derive the types, you know, used by the function from the mangling. Do you follow me? Yeah, people say that. People think that. Well, they're wrong because for instance, the return types of functions are not part of the mangling. Only the parameters are part of the mangling. And here, I made that change on purpose. You see that the return type of the function changed. And we want to catch that too. So we really need to go look at the debug info and analyze all that, you know. So you see here that the next change it shows us is that the first parameter, which is a pointer to the class C, changed. Well, and how did it change? It changed because the thing that is pointed to by that pointer, which is C, changed. How did C changed? It had one base class insertion. You remember I said that I added a new base class. I mean, C inherit a new class. So we can catch that too by looking at the binary, and this is what we do. And as a result of all those changes, the size of C changes too. This is something you cannot see by just looking at the source code, right? Well, you can see that it might change, but you're not sure. Actually, the reason why the size changed here is because of the virtual. You remember I added a virtual keyword to the destructor. So because of that virtual that I added, a vtable got added to the class. And the vtable is added at the beginning. And it's the vtable. The vtable is the reason why the size changed here, actually. So we see here that there is a vtable insertion. And we can say at which line it was inserted and the vtable offset, et cetera, et cetera. And as a result, because something got inserted at the beginning of the class, the offset of all the data members of the class changed too.
Right.
So we have these changes too. Just by changing, just by adding a virtual, right? So yeah, we can learn a lot by just looking at the binaries. So now I guess I'm done with showing off what we can do with this kind of tooling. So what do we do behind the scenes? Basically, Abigail and, well, what I call it LibAbigail because it's the name of the project. LibAbigail being the library that implements all the stuff and also a library of tools that come with on top of that library. So basically, we represent ABI artifact. What does that mean? We have an in-memory models for types and declarations, just like a compiler does, just like LLVM, you know, does. Abigail represents scalar types, you know, integers, characters, and so on and so forth. Aggregate types that are arrays, structures, classes, unions, blah, blah, blah. And declarations, a declaration being something that has a name and a type. So all those things are represented. You can write code saying, okay, this is a function. The function has parameters, and I'm adding a new parameter. You know, you can manipulate those things. On top of that, Abigail has a model of what I call bundles of ABI artifacts. The first bundle is obviously a translation unit. So whenever you look at a binary, the binary has debug information when it has, and that debug information describe things translation unit per translation unit, right? And it is inside those translation units that you have declarations and their types. So we represent those translation unit in the Abigail model. And we represent what we call ABI corpus. An ABI corpus is the representation of a set of translation units. So basically a shared library, the ABI things, artifacts of a shared library, is represented in Abigail speak as an ABI corpus. That's how we call it. And once we have ABI corpora, yeah, because the plural of corpus, it's a Latin word, is corpora, I was told, anyway. So when you have those corpora, you can, well, compare them, you know. And so, as usual, we build a model of the diff. If you make a parallel with the GNU diff tool, when the GNU diff tool, computes the difference of two files, what does it do with the difference? It just emits it. If you look at the source code, it's what it does. It sees the difference, boom, it emits it as a text. Doesn't do anything with that difference. In our case, we build a model of the difference. And we actually build a tree, you know, a graph of those differences. So if there is a difference between two structures, for instance, that difference might come from the fact that one of the data members of those two structures changed, right? So you will have one tree representing the, you know, the two structures, difference between the two structures, and a child tree node representing, you know, the detail of that change, the detail being the change of the data members. Do you understand what I mean? And like that, you have a full graph of the changes in memory. Once we have that, we can categorize the changes. I mean, we can walk the changes and mark them, saying, okay, this change is that kind of change. Because, I don't know, for instance, in C++, you can have a change about, I don't know, private, the private data member becoming public. You know, this is a change. But it might not be the same kind of change as removing, you know, a data member. So we will put the first change in a category named private change category, and the second change will be put in another category. So categorizing changes. One of the good things about categorizing changes is that we can see changes that come over and over. In the previous example I show you, you've seen that there were two functions using the class C, right? Function F1 and F2. If you don't remember, I'm telling you again. But then in the report, you saw the change about F1 only, saying F1 change, blah, 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 and then, you know, because of C. And you didn't see the change about F2. Well, F2 changed too because of C. You didn't see it because the tool categorized the changes on F2 as being redundant. Redundant, why? Because it's the same C that changed, that we've seen before. If we have time, we can go back, and I'll show you how to, you know, ABI Dev has an option to show you the redundant changes too, if you want to see everything, you know. And we can do this kind of analysis because we keep a model of the changes in memory. We don't just emit those changes as soon as we see them. One thing that is interesting too that I wanted to show, but time is moving, but we can come back to that later if we're earlier, is what we call suppression specifications. You know about Valgrind, right? Yeah. In Valgrind, you have suppressions. You know that. It's the best thing ever in Valgrind, right? You have an error that keeps popping. You know about it, but you don't want to see that error again because for you, it's noise, right? Suppression specifications. We have the same thing in libabigail, actually. So, it's a bit more complicated, well, let's say evolved than in Valgrind, because you can say things that like, don't show me changes about a type which name is foo. But you can also say, okay, don't show me changes about that type if the change is an addition, a new member, added at the end of C. Or you can say things like, don't show me changes about function f if f is part of a file named blah, blah, blah. You know, there are many, many different things you can express, and of course, those things come from users who are saying, I have this case where, you know, I would like to, you know, and okay, can you do something? You know, and I'll say, we discuss the price, and yeah, you know, we end up with something, a new category. So we do these kind of things. So afterwards, we report about the changes, and reporting means, again, walking the graph of diffs. And depending on the category of a diff node, report about it or not. If the category says, oh, this node has been suppressed by the user, then you won't report it, right? If the category says, oh, this is a type def name change. Sometimes you have changes like that. You have an intent in, I don't know, you have, you have somewhere you have a type that is an integer, and someone renamed that, well, someone defines a type def, saying, you know, that integer's name is now fancy type, for instance. So this is not a real you know, it's a change, but it's not necessarily harmful, right? Some folks want to be able to, you know, suppress those things. So we have a category for those kind of changes too. So the reporting engine knows about categorization and decides to show things depending on that. And of course, for now, we only have one kind of text reports. But we could have more, but well, that's what we have. So we've just seen what we can build as an in-memory model, right? So where do we build that model from? We build it from reading ELF and Dwarf. Dwarf is the format for debug info in ELF, basically. Those guys like Tolkien's books, and well, I guess, but anyway. So in libabigl, there is a reader component that knows how to read ELF, so it's written in C++. And from that, it builds the Abigail model I was talking to you about earlier in memory. So it does that for shared libraries, object files, and also actually also executable if I don't mention that here. Once we have that, once we can read from ELF, build a model. Well, we can also write it down in files, obviously. So that people can define snapshots of the ABI of a binary or a package. You have a binary, you don't want to put that into Git. Well, you can extract its ABI and stash that ABI into Git. The format is an XML ad hoc format we came up with, and we call that ABI XML. And of course, we can read it back. So this is interesting because once you read it back, well, you build an Abigail model, and so it lets you be able to, to compare. Well, I'll talk about that later. You can compare a binary against an ABI XML file. Because you can read both. We come up with the in-memory model, and then we can work on the in-memory model. So, which brings me to the tooling, around libabigl. So I'll just skim quickly through some of the tools we have today. So first we have ABI DW, which emits, it serializes the ABI representation of a binary to a text file. That's a tool. We have ABI Diff that you've seen. So ABI Diff can compare two binaries, two ABI XML file, or one ABI XML file and one binary, things like that. So you can compare a binary against a baseline. There is ABI package diff that compares the ABI of binaries that are inside RPMs or dep files. So that was written for someone else, and now I maintain it. And the last one that came to the family is Fed ABI package diff. These guys keep coming with the longer names. We need to do something about this. I didn't write this one. Someone else, a colleague, who wrote it on his own time, by the way. So this one is interesting. It talks, ABI package diff, so that you have things in mind, it works on RPMs. But when you work on RPMs, the debug info is split, it's in a separate package, right? So you've seen with ABI diff, when we want to compare two binaries, we just need the two binaries. If you want to compare two packages, you need actually four. Yeah, because you need the two debug info, right, packages. So the command line starts being a bit longer, right? You can actually need even more in certain cases because, Abigail sees everything, basically. I mean, there are some changes. I should show you some examples, but there are some changes that to some types that some developers don't want to see because they say that, oh, this type is private, whatever that means. In ELF, there is no such concept as a private type. But what the developer means by that, it means that type was not defined in the public header shipped by the, you know, the package or whatever. That's what it means by private. But in the binary, we see all the types. We don't care about, you know, so we tell you about all the changes. So people came to me saying, oh, I don't want to see the changes about those types. So there is an option to ABI package diff in which you give it the devel packages in which there are the header files, right? And so it won't show you changes about types that are not defined in the header files. So six packages. You need six packages just to run, you know, ABI package diff. That's a bit too much when you type command lines. So fed ABI package diff is quite handy because you can type it. The name is long, but then afterwards it becomes shorter. You say fed ABI package diff dash dash from. You say Fedora 10 or I don't know dash dash to Fedora 20 HTTPD, the HTTPD package. So it will go fetch all the packages, the HTTPD packages from Fedora 10 and 20. You know, the debug info packages, devel packages, whatever, compare them and show you the difference. So that's what it does. So maybe we would need something like this for OBS or, well, just saying. Anyway, so this is the part of the talk I'm going to change if I go talk to the Debian guys. But anyway, so yeah, I'm talking out loud here. It's a chance that it's not recorded, right? So doing this, we faced and we're still facing some interesting challenges. Speed and space matters a lot more than what people think. When you're dealing with something like Libabigail, you are looking at the entire binary. And usually your compilation toolchain, even your compilation toolchain usually doesn't do that, unless you do something called LTO, but we'll put that aside. Usually your compiler just compiles things file by file, translation unit by translation unit, right? And the linker that sees everything doesn't analyze types, right? So it doesn't see types either. We see all the types of all the translation units of the shell library. So that it can be a lot. Especially when you have like big C++ binaries. And this is also due to the fact that the same types get included over and over and over again. Did I forget an over? Okay, over again. This is thanks to the famous dash include, hash include thing that I love, right? So think about it. We build in-memory representation for those types, for all of them. If we have hundreds of thousands of types in memory, that can do a lot. You can end up with gigabytes and gigabytes of memory used just to represent those types. And you need two copies because, of course, you're comparing two libraries, right? So we need to do something about that. We need to deduplicate those types. So basically what it means, compiler people have fancy names for easy concept. When you see a type foo first time, okay, type foo, and then you go to the next translation unit and you see type foo again, you shouldn't rebuild an in-memory representation for this foo. You should reuse the first one you saw, deduplication. But to do that, so it's an easy concept. But then to do that, you need to be fast. Because how do you know that the second foo is the same one as the first one? It is not because it is named foo that it is necessarily the same as the first one. In C++, normally, it should be the same because there is something named the one definition rule, which is a C++ rule saying that if two entities have the same name, then they ought to be the same entity. But then in C, you don't have such thing. Yeah, C, anyway. So in C, you can have foo in a file. The same, okay, a different foo in a other file. The two foos are used by external functions, and they're not the same. So to be able to know that we want to deduplicate things. So we need to know if the second foo is the same as the first one. So we need to compare them. And comparison, by construction, is an exponential problem. You compare things member-wise, and those members have types themselves that are structures that have members that are types that are structures that blah blah blah, and then you end up, you know, it's exponential. And seriously, I mean, if you do these things naively, it can take hours to complete just to compare two packages. So we need to use some heuristics to transform the problem into a more linear one so that things can complete quickly. So it's kind of, there are some interesting, you know, graph algorithms underneath. We also need to control, to avoid seeing things we don't want to see. And when I say this, when I say we, the we depends on the project. A change, an ABI change for your project might be harmless, and that very same change might be harmful for his project. He might want to see those. So we need to give you ways to avoid seeing what you don't want to see. So this is why we came up with suppression specifications, but it goes further. For instance, if you have a file named that ends up with .abiignore, in your package, in your RPM file, ABI package diff will detect that and use it, for instance, as a suppression specification, right? And think about it. If you build, for instance, an ABI verifier at the distro level, you will need to provide users with this kind of capabilities, provide them with the ability to say, okay, this change is okay, I don't want to see it again in my next runs. And of course, this is a library that we're talking about, not only tools, so it needs more documentation. So basically, all the entry points need to be documented, and we're doing that already, but we need more documentation about the inside and things like that. It needs, and we're doing it. I mean, the things that are in this section, challenges, are things we're doing already, but I wanted to, you know, stress on them so that you guys are aware of that. We need a huge set of binaries for regression testing. ELF and DWARF is a very loose format. You can put everything, anything in ELF or in DWARF. So unless you test stuff, you don't know what you are expecting or what you're really doing. So we need a lot of tests. So the libabigail tarball is more than 100 megabytes, of size. The reason is that we have lots of binaries just for testing when you run make check. And we need even more than that. And that now what we're planning to do is to actually use Fed ABI package diff or something else to go actually use the packages in the distros and distro histories to use that as regression testing. You know, for instance, if you compare a package against itself, it should yield the empty set, right? For instance, just doing that on thousands of packages will be good. So this is really important, just like we test compilers. So in Fedora, we're using this thing to compare the ABI of new, you know, packages that are pushed. So it's been in production since a couple of months. Basically, we perform an ABI diff of the new package against the previous stable one, and it sends a friendly message to the package maintainer. So the changes are categorized. Now you know what category is, basically. But roughly, in this case, it's less detailed than what we can do, basically. But this is what they wanted. There are certain kinds of changes for which we are sure that they're going to cause a problem. Incompatible ABI change. For instance, removed symbols. For those are flagged as failed, you know, for, you know, the build, basically. And the most interesting changes, you know, for instance, the changes I show you about the subtypes of functions, those are flagged as need inspection. If your package, the package maintainer needs to inspect the package in those cases, and otherwise the package is flagged as passed as far as this ABI test is concerned. So it is based on Taskotron. I think you guys know about that. The task that runs on each package is named ABI check. You can Google that, and it uses ABI package diff to perform those things. It's written in Python, so that's it. At the same time, package maintainers can use FedABI package diff, so they don't have to wait until they've submitted their package, you know, to try to see ABI changes. And so it is in productions. The limitations, you know it. It only works on C and C++ shared libraries today. But well, tomorrow, if folks doing Rust want support, I mean, if it is Elf, we can support it. You just need some work. And it just runs on a several hundred packages of, you know, packages that are in the critical path, they call that. And improvement that we need. So I've just ticked this here. So I'm currently working on supporting, you know, the comparison of Linux kernels. This is it's well underway. The Linux kernel is huge because we're not just comparing VM Linux, we're comparing the union of VM Linux and all the modules. There's a couple of those. And the Linux kernel has its own way of handling ELF, so it's quite interesting. So we need more, you know, better support of C and C++ language construct, mostly C++, you know, the new stuff, lambdas and blah, 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 you know, the new stuff. It keeps coming, it just needs work to keep, because we basically have, it's like a compiler what we have, you know. You need to parse. There is a front end, which is the dwarf thing, which builds a middle end representation, which is, you know, the Abigail model, and then, well, the back end is emitting report, blah. So people will come with better ABI change categorization requests, saying, this change, you categorize it as harmful, harmless. Please, can you put that in harmful, please? And we'll discuss, and you know, we'll see how we can do that. Some people want additional ABI change reports. You see here in the report I show you first, we show the changes, but we also show the impact. You know, what are the functions that are impacted, or global variables? Some people just want to see the types that changed, and don't care about the functions that were impacted because there are so many types, you know. So it's a valid request. So we would need, well, we can do that. We have all the information to do that. We just need to, you know, emit other kinds of reports for that. Some people want more friendly web reporting. We need work from that. And someone even came with a crazy idea of something web, blah. Anyway, you know. So you submit two packages and the thing does its thing and shows you web reports. You know, anyway, so if someone wants to do that, it will be great. But I don't know if, well, maybe I can try and learn some JavaScript. But anyway, so yeah, that's it from me, I guess. Now is the time of question. I'm sorry, but I finished on time. Now you should do the same. You have 2 minutes.
What architectures does it support? Only x86-64 or also?
Right now, it is known to work on x86, ARM, PowerPC, you know, and even stuff. The right answer is if we have dwarf, if we on elf, it should work. PowerPC showed that there are some corner cases sometimes, but in theory it should work, yeah.
And another question, does it also catch calling convention changes?
This is an interesting question. Right now, no. Short answer. But there is I have a Bugzilla open to support that. Not necessarily calling convention changes, but not necessarily only that, but things that are more subtle than that. For instance, a parameter, the second parameter of a function, the way that parameter is passed can change from a compiler to another. For instance, you have an LLVM generated binary that passes that parameter by on the stack, and GCC will pass that or the other way around in registers, things like that. So the idea is to be sure that we have that information in Dwarf. And if we have that, and I think we have part of it, then we can implement it on our side.
Well, if the structure if the size of the structures changes, can you somehow detect from the library code whether it is IBA compatible or not? This is a problem when the function fills the whole structure, including the last member, and the size is in the public interface, then it could override a data.
Okay, to me, so if I understand the question correctly, is if the size changes, can we say if that change is compatible or not? Right, to answer that question, well, I would say that if that size change impacts another type, right, that uses that type which size changed, then it's ABI incompatible, right? But then there is not only an impact. The impact is not necessarily only on other types. It can be on code too. You can have code that says size of that structure, right? So my short answer will be, if the size changes, it's bad, period. If it's not bad, then you haven't looked close enough. Because the question came out, you know, over and over. And you know, for instance, if a code says size of, that size of is lost because, you know, it's a constant and we don't see that in the generated code anymore. So I don't think we can really be sure that we're, you know, doing the complete impact analysis of these kind of things. And I think we would err on the safe side by saying that this is bad, period. If you do it, you know that, you know, it's potentially bad, yeah.
Yeah.
It's bad.
You mentioned that you were looking for ways to identify whether certain structs are the same in C, which doesn't have to use ODR. Have you thought about building like an MD5 sum of a struct and then comparing that?
Oh, to us, the problem is solved. I mean, well, it's solved. But the question is interesting. If to build an MD5 sum or a sum, you need to walk the structure, right? What I want to avoid is to walk the structure. Exactly. And that is what we do. That's what I meant by saying that trying to transform the problem from an exponential one to a linear one. This is basically the kind of technique we use. We use some kind of hashing, you know, to avoid walking over and over. We just walk once per type, name and kind. Yes. It's just that the hash that we end up using is not, we don't save it. It's just in memory. So I guess thank you very much.